Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
Check, check. Hello everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Gaming in the Wild, a video games podcast about games from the artistic, creative side of the tracks, from indie to AAA. My name's John, I'm your host. I am a social media manager based out in Reykjavik, Iceland, where it's been an interesting week. It was my first week on the job at Dot Big Bang, the company I'm now working for. It's a really fun browser-based game where you can build worlds and you can play games. And I've had a really interesting first week getting my feet under the table, learning more about what the platform is all about, building some voxel objects, which I found to be a really relaxing pastime, actually. So I've been making some voxel objects, dragging them into environments, and having a lot of fun doing it. If you want to see what I'm talking about, it's at dotbigbang.com, and I'll be working on that project and probably talking about it a bit more, actually. I think people seem to find it pretty interesting. Not that I'm going to be spamming you all with loads of Dot Big Bang stuff, but I will be talking about my progress and letting you know how all of that is going. But today's episode is about a game that I have covered once before. It's probably my favourite game that I've played this year, and I'm certain it's going to be on my end-of-year list. It came out last year on Steam and Mac and PC, and it came out this year on the consoles. It's the card-based conversation game Signs of the Sojourner, and it's a special episode about the game, because a couple of weeks ago I sat down and had a really good talk with Diala Katan Wright, the director of the game, and the head of Echo Dog Studios, which produced Signs of the Sojourner, and we had a really good long chat about some of the ins and outs of the game, the design process, the vision for it, and where the idea came from, and how all of those different things were interwoven with this really beautiful vision of the future that Signs of the Sojourner creates. But before the interview, I will talk, as I always do, a little bit about games that I've played in the last week. There's been less time for games. I've been more attached to the screen than usual, doing emails and all of that sort of stuff. So I found that in the evening I've been doing other things just to decompress a little bit. But I've still been playing some games. I actually finished two more of the base characters in Slay the Spire, which I covered in full three or four episodes ago. I've now finished the game as the Silent, the really fast, agile assassin character, and also as the Defect, the really cool robot character. And so when you finish the game with the Ironclad Knight, the Silent, and the Defect, something new opens up. So I'm now in this kind of endgame period where I just have to complete one more run as any of those characters, collect three parts of a kind of a Triforce on the way, and then I will face a final boss. So I'm really making good progress on Slay the Spire, and I'm really enjoying it still, honestly. I play one or two runs a day, and I'm having a great time with it. I really like what they did with the other characters. The Ironclad is this kind of knight-like slugger with a big sword. The Silent is this really fast character where you get loads more turns and loads of kind of shiv attacks. They're free-to-play cards that cause a little bit of damage, and you can throw them into your hand. And so it's a whole different playstyle, and it actually feels like a more flowing, speedy character that you're controlling, which I think is like a real achievement, given that it's a card game. And the same goes for the Defect. The Defect is a robot character, and you renew your cards, and they're all named after processes like defragment and things like that. and they all carry out different functions in the game. And you renew your energy, which lets you play more cards again. So sometimes I think I've been playing up to 10 or 15 cards in a turn where I began only able to play three, because I've been tuning the defect to try and create more energy. So you can get into these great flows of just playing card after card after card, and then renewing your energy again using a card called Overtime, I think it's called, or Overclock, or Turbo Mode, all of these kind of computery terms. And the Defect was a really fun and really different kind of character. So I'm very excited to get into the end game of Slay the Spire, and I'm hoping that I can have one more successful run and get all the way to the end of the game. I've also been playing a little more Wasteland 3 on Game Pass, making good progress there. A really enjoyable game. I talked about it last episode. I did encounter a game-breaking bug in Wasteland 3, where I came to a point at which I was trapped in a piece of dialogue, but the dialogue options weren't selectable, so I was just really stuck. I was kind of resetting the game, starting it again, closing it down, trying to reload my save file, and I was completely stuck until I Googled it and went into the dark depths of Reddit. And somewhere in those dark depths, someone had come across the same problem, which seems to be Xbox-specific. And it's a really nasty bug. What you have to do is go into a certain part of the room, remove one person from your party, and then go back and try and trigger the conversation again with that person far enough away from you that they don't take part in the dialogue, and then it works. And I kind of spent a good half hour trying to make it work before I found that tip, and a good other 15 minutes actually making it work. So that was 45 minutes trying to get around a game-breaking bug that is in the main storyline. So it's not like an optional quest or some obscure side mission. It's core gameplay. So I was really surprised to find that in Wasteland 3, because I have been enjoying that game. It did take the wind out of my sails a little bit, and so I took a break from it, and I haven't gone back yet. But I plan to. I am enjoying it. I also played a little bit of Outriders, the game that came out this year by People Can Fly, the people behind Bulletstorm, another game that I've covered in a past episode, and published by Square Enix. And this is a really interesting one too. It's a third-person action-adventure with an interesting story. It's about colonizing an alien world, and the game begins when you land in the advanced team on that alien world after having traveled through space with the last remnants of humanity in hypersleep, and you come down to check that the planet is safe. And at first it all seems good, but even in the first 20 minutes of the game it becomes apparent that there are some strange things going on in this world, and you're cast into quite an interesting adventure. But this one is an odd game. It feels like it could have been an excellent third-person action adventure if that's what they had focused on, but it seems that they have focused on making it, as all games tend to do at the moment, some kind of online multiplayer arena shooter. And so you're kind of being pushed towards that at some points in the game. It's always trying to edge you towards multiplayer. And when you enter new areas, for example, if you start a new chapter and go into this kind of underworld area to progress the story, it says you are now entering Battle Arena 3, which is really jarring, because you can tell that the game has been set up to be this kind of multiplayer shooter, but they've tried to kind of square the circle of having a first-person campaign also, but the two sit very awkwardly together. And so you have these great story sections, and then you have these kind of obligatory-feeling arenas where you just have to shoot a bunch of people to get to the next story segment. So it feels to me to be a little bit clumsily plugged together. It's like they wanted the game to be Horizon Zero Dawn, but they also wanted it to be Overwatch, and they haven't picked a lane. They've decided to try and do both lanes. And as someone that is kind of a first player campaign aficionado, as I am, I found it jarring, because I could kind of see the joins between those two games that they've tried to squeeze into one. But I did like Outriders. It's visually spectacular. It looks really top end, and the story is compelling. I really like the character. You get to build your own character, but the script is good, the premise is good. It feels like a kind of a Netflix show that I would watch, like a sci-fi Netflix show that I'd watch for sure. But I haven't quite fallen in love with it yet because of those reasons that I've outlined. But I think I'm going to come back to Outriders. And so those are the games I've been playing. It's time for the interview, but I will say this interview needs a little bit of an introduction, because I made a bit of an error when I was editing this interview, and I accidentally merged two audio files that shouldn't have been merged, and then I could not disentangle them again. The undo option was not an option. And so this interview has some pretty serious echo on my voice. You can hear Diala perfectly clearly, but throughout the interview you will notice that my voice sounds like I'm in a giant cathedral. It's very echoey. And I'd thought twice about whether I should publish it, but I really liked the interview and the conversation that I had with Diala. So I do hope that the echoey audio from my side isn't too distracting for you. And I hope that you can still enjoy the great conversation that I had with Diala. So my apologies for the echo. That is my fault. It was a noob podcast production error. Lessons learned, and hopefully next time I won't merge the files. But before that interview begins, I'll also mention that this podcast is patron-supported. If you are a first-time listener who enjoys what you hear today, or if you're a long-time listener who's been checking out episodes over time, you're welcome to come to patreon.com/gamingintheWild, where for as little as a dollar a month, you can support the show, get access to the Discord server, where myself and other patrons and friends talk about what we're playing and share screenshots and tips and sale alerts and things like that. You'll also get occasional extra episodes and some sale tips. Every week or two, I'll post some sale tips from PlayStation and Switch and Steam and places like that, recommending games that you can pick up for cheap. So if you're interested in supporting this show, I really appreciate it. The community really lifts me, and it's great to know that people out there are enjoying what I'm doing. It gives me good impetus to continue. So it's patreon.com/gamingintheWild if you're interested in that. And with that out of the way, here is my interview with Diala Catan-Wright, and a very echoey me. I hope you enjoy it. I'm very happy to be here this week with a special guest, Diala Catan-Wright, who is the designer of Signs of the Sojourner, one of my favourite games of the year that was covered on the podcast in a recent episode. Hello, Diala.
Hi, thanks for having me on here.
And how are you in the heat wave?
I'm doing well, staying in the AC.
Thanks for joining us, I really appreciate it. I played Signs of the Sojourner recently after hearing about it on the Short Game podcast, which is one of my favourites, and they gave it some high praise. So I checked it out, and it was my first deck-based game, actually. I'd not played one before, and I found myself absolutely absorbed in it and played through the whole thing, I think, probably 7 times now, trying to unlock all the little corners of the map.
Oh, wow,
and every time I did, I seemed to find more things to be intrigued by and more things to discover. I found it to be a really fascinating game.
Thanks. That's really great to hear that you've gone through it so many times. And it's got to be an interesting kind of first introduction to deck building games, too, because it's quite different from other ones, I'd say.
Right. I think it's a nice, gentle introduction. But since then, I went and got addicted to Iris and the Giant and Slay the Spire, so it was definitely the gateway drug with deck builders.
That's great.
But I was wondering if we could start with maybe just a little bit about yourself, your background, and how Echo Dog came to be.
Sure. So I actually started off working at Nickelodeon on MMOs for kids back in the day. And from there, I spent a few years in mobile games, which is where I met my two partners on Signs, Holly and Zach. And several years after that is when kind of this nebulous idea I had for a while kind of solidified enough to actually, you know, want to get a team together to try making the game.
Mm-hmm. And has Echo Dog been like your gig? Since this game came out, it seemed to do quite well. It seems to have been widely reviewed and well thought of.
Yeah, not quite as well as I had hoped, but that's been, you know, since the ports came out a few months ago, kind of have started focusing on what the next game will be and trying to get together pitches for that. So still a bit too early to talk about it. But yeah, I mean, the hope is, of course, to continue with Echo Dogs, making more games.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the first nebulous idea of the game. And that's something that's been pretty interesting to me, actually, because there's so much to love about this game from the different angles that it gives you in terms of the background and the scenario, and the character story, and the central mechanic. I was wondering, actually, what occurred to you first, and what was the seed that it grew from?
So it largely came out of the mechanics first. I had, for years, been kind of thinking about ways to explore dialogue beyond, you know, dialogue trees. And a lot of it, which didn't really come through in Signs, but things like, you know, with dialogue trees, I'd often want to be able to, you know, bluff or lie or make a threat that I don't have to follow through on. But in dialogue trees, it was like none of that, you know, subtext is there. And so I think it was actually playing Slay the Spire as well, where I kind of started to think of cards as one of these possible ways to kind of alternately explore dialogue and conversations in games. And of course, that was such a broad thing that once we actually sat down and started figuring out, you know, what does it actually mean to play cards, to have a dialogue, of course, the, you know, that went through so many iterations, and a lot of the things that we had originally identified as, you know, this is where dialogue trees fall short and we'd like to explore, you know, not necessarily all of those things that we address, but I think kind of the direction we went in of trying to capture the feeling of dialogue, even if we're not necessarily, you know, like I said, allowing you to bluff or lie or do anything so explicit, but kind of going for this abstract feeling, felt much more powerful and a much better fit for kind of gamifying conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, something that I don't know how long ago you started the game, but the kind of the general discourse in the US being as divided as it is, with different people with very different mentalities, which are kind of represented in this game. I mean, playing it now after everything that's happened in the US political discourse and having people that speak in squares and triangles that can't communicate with people that speak in circles and other shapes, but learning how to bridge that gap in language and understanding, it seemed kind of quite powerful given the context in which the game exists. You know, was that something that was intentional or just arose from the process?
It was intentional. A lot of it came out of our own experiences traveling abroad, and I think in some ways the game might put a little bit too much of a negative spin on like the inability to connect with everyone. But the flip side of that was we wanted it to kind of reflect the difficulty, and finding that balance meant that part of it was that no, you couldn't connect with everyone. But no, we did start development a couple years ago. So this past year, kind of, you know, it wasn't intentional, but it certainly highlighted a lot of the themes that we were already exploring anyways.
Mm-hmm. It is pretty gentle though, isn't it? I mean, even when you have like a failure to communicate in the game, it's never like, you know, it's never like a fist fight. It's pretty gentle in where things end up, and you always get another chance to come back and talk to them again.
Yeah, and that was something that I definitely wanted to explore, was that certainly you sometimes have these kind of really antagonistic arguments, and there is some of that, but I would say that for most people, you know, when you have misunderstandings, when you have disagreements, it's often like, just because it is a misunderstanding or because you're just coming from different perspectives and can't quite understand each other, rather than it being this really kind of, you know, head-to-head battle.
Mm. Yeah, and you do get the opportunity to... I haven't explained the card system for anyone that hasn't played the game yet that's listening, but it's a card matching game in which conversation is kind of a collaborative activity with your partner, where you're kind of symbol matching, right? So if they put down a square, you have to match their square, and then they have to match the next shape that you put down. So it's almost like dominoes, right? It's like you're trying to kind of build something together rather than trying to win the conversation.
Yeah, and a large part of that was trying to encourage the player to think about what the NPC might have in their deck and how they've played cards in the past, and kind of not only as you get to know how that character plays, but also kind of understanding, for instance, the shapes that you can expect to find in their town, and kind of associating a culture of sorts with a place and with the people, and trying to accommodate that rather than just being able to bulldoze through, you know, a bunch of dialogue options and kind of get your way.
Mm. Yeah, most of the time it did feel gentle. I was very happy that when a conversation with Matilde, my favorite character, went wrong, then she was still really nice to you, you know. I think there was maybe one occasion when I was trying to talk to Sebastian, the painter. Is his name Sebastian? Seb?
The painter, Tomas?
Tomas, yeah, sorry. I'm thinking Swedish names. when you talk to Tomas at the very end of the game, having built up a relationship with him and bought his paintings and kind of coached him through his insecurity, and then coming back right at the end and he's thinking about leaving, and I think I failed the conversation and didn't get the closure with him and felt real sad about it. I was like, oh no, I had a nasty conversation with Tomas. So it does give you that kind of feeling of slight tinges of regret when conversations go wrong that you might get in real life when you've, you know, crossed words with someone or spoken badly.
Yeah, and a big part of that was wanting to capture that, like, sure, you know, you kind of had a breakdown of communication, but it wasn't because either of you were, you know, angry at the other or out to get the other. It was just, you know, you are concerned with different things. You're, you know, focusing on different kinds of ideas or worldviews, and whatever connection you had is kind of broken down a little bit. And hopefully, you know, the idea is that even though, you know, that's the end of your conversations with them, that's the end of the game, like, hopefully it leaves you with the feeling that, you know, you could have good conversations with him if the game went on.
Yeah, sometimes life is like that, right? You don't always get the kind of the neat bow on the end of a relationship or a conversation, and I didn't that time. But as I played through my 7 times, I definitely got to be nice to Tomas and see him move town and everything.
That's great. I love that you played through it so many times. Did you have a favorite sort of path through the game?
Yeah, I never fully went to, and I still haven't fully explored the northeastern side properly, because I think by the time you get there, you're quite fatigued often, and it's quite a tough area to focus on. So I did most of the west side, and the southeast corner was my favorite. All the little relationships and plot points that go on down there, and the character of the towns and the people were really fun. So that's where I ended up. I think the last couple times that I played, I was trying to get to Perseray to tie up a plot point there. And it took me a few goes around to finally get there, but it was worth it.
I'm glad you managed it.
Thank you. But as well as the conversation aspect of this game, something that kind of dawned on me slowly as I was playing it, because it's not kind of front and center on how the game has been described, is the climate fiction aspect of the game and the kind of the really interesting take that it has on the future. Because, you know, the video games are rife with visions of the future, and many of them are apocalyptic, broken-down visions, like of the Mad Max science fiction variety or the Fallout science fiction variety, where, you know, humanity's kind of culture has dissolved and regressed and turned into warlike factions. And something that I really loved about this game was that it had an alternative vision of the future where the world has broken down, but it hasn't regressed. Culture still exists. People are trying to get by. People are being nice to each other. And it felt like such a kind of a powerful alternate vision in a very cluttered sci-fi landscape. And I was wondering about how that came together.
Yeah, so a large part of it, I would say, is, you know, like you said, we're inundated with these kind of bleak future visions. And especially when thinking of these kinds of these problems like climate change that feel impossible, and, you know, how are we going to manage that? What's going to happen? And while I don't have answers for that, it's, you know, I love the idea of, you know, the power of people coming together, of communities supporting each other, and being able to tackle these huge problems and support each other through them. And so I definitely wanted to capture that in the setting overall. And of course, not completely ignore the problems of climate change. You know, many of these communities are suffering, and communication is broken down, and travel is difficult, and everything. But ultimately, as much as there are kind of bittersweet, melancholy moments, we wanted the overall feeling of the game to be optimistic, and you know, to acknowledge that there are these extremely difficult, huge problems, but you know, hang on to the thought that by coming together, by, you know, supporting your community, we can get through these really difficult things.
Right. I like that it didn't say that, like, after climate breakdown and infrastructure breakdown and people going back to subsistence living, that it was kind of utopian by any means. The land is dried up and there are kind of violent weather problems, and I think at some point on the Wavecatcher? Is that the name of the boat?
Yeah. Wavedancer,
yeah. And there's a mention of a disease outbreak that had occurred, and up in Anka, the city's kind of urban environment has become difficult for the people who live there for other reasons. And so it does take a look at the various problems that could occur in quite a kind of compartmentalized and interesting way. And I was wondering how much kind of, is that something that you had a pre-existing interest in, or was it something that you dove into for research? Like, what might this future look like? Could you tell me about how you kind of arrived at this future?
Yeah, so a large part of kind of the initial themes were, like I mentioned, about travel and our own experiences with travel, and partly kind of like food as an introduction to different cultures and a connection to identity and all this. But when we sat down to actually start building out the world and thinking about, like, okay, what places are you visiting? You know, who are you meeting? We very much wanted to explore these sorts of modern day problems that are important to us. But at the same time, not, you know, trying to spread too thin, tackling too many difficult themes. So we kind of designed each town to have some sort of, like you said, compartmentalization, so that, you know, we can kind of focus on different issues that concern us, but still kind of have the main overarching theme be of travel and personal growth.
I mean, it seems like you read things in, you know, in the newspaper about what's going on around the world with some areas that are suffering from subsiding and rising sea, and others that are suffering from kind of drying out and the kind of disease that arrives and the difficulties that arrive. And it's quite a kind of, it's very gently delivered because it's all anecdotal stories that you get from people that you meet. And was that something that was important to you, to kind of deliver this gently and not have it be a kind of front and center bannered kind of climate future warning game?
Yeah, even, you know, when we were talking with one of our writers early on, it was kind of, I wanted to emphasize, like, we're avoiding calling this post-apocalypse. It's I guess you could say, like, post-apocalypse in a way, which I do kind of like stories in that setting where, like, yeah, something, you know, there has been some breakdown, but society is far enough past that it's kind of started to come back together. And in this world, I didn't imagine it ever, like, being Mad Max style. you know, the idea that breakdowns will necessarily mean, you know, everyone becoming violent monsters. Like, no, you know, no matter how bad things get, people go on with their lives and with their families and with their communities. And, you know, supporting each other and trying to get on as best they can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, post-apocalypse, I guess. So what other kind of works of kind of fiction or games can you kind of think of that are in that category that appeal to you in that way of being a kind of a more gentle or nuanced or less kind of violent vision of the future? Were there any other worlds that you looked at or things that you're into?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't call it an influence on the game, but when I think of post-apocalypse, I think of shows like Adventure Time or Steven Universe that, you know, are that, but are still, you know, these positive, and of course those are kid shows, but still, you know, positive, and they do explore adult themes, but always in this kind of gentle, hopeful way.
Mm-hmm. Right, I mean, it makes me think of, oh, carry on, please.
I was just going to say, you know, the goal with this was certainly not to target children. It's meant for adults, but, you know, still wanting to have that kind of, like you said, gentle, you know, hopefully pose these interesting questions, have players think about these things, but in a kind of overall optimistic way.
I guess it's seemingly a kind of intentionally nebulous sort of setting, culturally or geographically. It could kind of fit in various places. I guess the map looks a little like North America, maybe, with this kind of green northeastern part and a kind of hot center. But the cultures that are in the game, it seems like a much more diverse, but it seems like an intentionally diverse set of communities and set of people that you put into the game. Was that something that was on your mind too?
Yeah, very much so. You know, a large part of it was wanting to, again, because we had these various kind of themes and you know, modern day problems we wanted to explore, but combined with the fact that, you know, just due to our limited resources, you know, there was going to be a small cast of characters, we were very worried about, you know, if we only have room to put in, you know, one character each of these real world cultures, then it's extremely hard to not make those into these, you know, kind of token characterized, you know, representations. And because we didn't have the resources to, like, have many characters from many different cultures, that felt too limiting, which was a large part of why we decided to not set it in the real world. But of course, still wanting to, you know, not make it a completely alien world. It still feels like it could be our, you know, the future of this world, without necessarily, you know, having that risk of, you know, such a limited cast not being able to well represent real people.
Right. It has got a nice welcome dash of sci-fi in it as well, hasn't it? With the kind of the farming robots that are wandering around and kind of little things like that. And this very mysterious character from a faraway land in the top left corner of the map. He seems to have come from somewhere else entirely.
Yeah, we had hoped to kind of have DLCs where you could explore where that character came from, but not to be. But yeah, I would say, you know, it gave us a chance to, like I said, kind of explore a lot, and also just from a scope and writing standpoint, you know, we obviously had these overarching story threads that lead you through several towns, but we also wanted most locations to have somewhat self-contained, you know, sub-stories, so that just for scope-wise, you know, it made it much more manageable when not every single thread had to be, you know, accounted for and in every single town. So a lot of the places, just being a little bit more self-contained, made it easier to handle the writing and, you know, plotting and everything.
Mm-hmm. It seems very concisely done, actually. Like, the dialogue is delivered to you in kind of tweet-length chunks, conversation bubble-sized chunks. But it feels like every single one of them has an intention in it. Was the process of kind of writing a process of building up and editing down? Or, like, how was it that it came together to be so crisp?
So it was, yeah, it was quite a long process. At first, we basically had tried to limit ourselves to having, like, a single dialogue bubble per sequence of cards matched, and that was, you know, that meant that we were either cramming in a whole lot of text at once, rather than breaking it up into kind of nice chunks, or just not having, you know, the space to kind of express what we needed to. So, you know, the amount of writing did grow quite a bit from the initial goals, but a lot of it was, you know, we got kind of, once we hit content complete and had everything in the game, it was a lot of just playing through and kind of seeing what felt like, oh, this, you know, this character runs on a bit too long, or this character who, you know, has a bunch of chatters isn't chattery enough, so, like, let's make them a bit more, you know, talkative, trying to kind of match both whatever story needs, but also to match the personality as represented in the cards. And that went both ways. You know, often the decks were edited to match the story needs and vice versa.
Right, and as well as the writing and the scenario, both of which are excellent throughout, I've really enjoyed this game as a whole package. The artwork and the music both contribute a lot to it as well. I was wondering if you could tell me about the decisions that led to your artist and your musician and how that came together.
Yeah, I mean, we had so many great collaborators. Holly, who was part of Echo Dog, handled all of the art and UI, and she's had kind of this little blurb that she's used about her process that I want to make sure I get right. I know, so a large part of for her process, I know, was wanting, one, something that didn't look derivative of other games. So I know early on when she was doing style explorations, she looked a lot of non-game media to kind of get inspirations. And then in terms of more specifics, things like wanting it to feel kind of childlike, but not childish, kind of as you're, you know, this young person going out into the world. And reflecting that in the UI too, where it's kind of presented as like these scraps of paper or notes that your mother might have left behind that now you're using to navigate this world. And of course, a lot of that too, like, you know, we went back and forth a lot on kind of the original designs for some of the original characters and towns, but kind of once we had established the main themes and the main goals, she actually kind of, like, a lot of the character design started with her, and then kind of we wrote around the characters that she came up with based on designs. You know, there were, of course, some times where it was like, okay, we need a character to put here to, you know, have this kind of deck to balance things out. But for the most part, a lot of the character designs started with the art. And so, you know, there's a lot of kind of motifs she's made to tie together characters of different places or to suggest mm-hmm. connections that might not be super explicit in the game, but if you kind of pay attention to, like, you know, the motifs in the character design, you can kind of see how, like, oh, people in this area tend to have, like, this kind of hairstyle.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, with Steve, who did the music, I can't recall, we found him through his company Skew Sound with Nick, who did the audio as well, the sound design. And yeah, I mean, that was, I don't have a great vocabulary for kind of talking about music and, like, what I want. So it was a lot of, you know, here's a Spotify playlist of things that I like and that feel appropriate. And I think it kind of was very much the kind of music he enjoys making, like, outside of professional context, too. So he was really into it and really receptive, too. I mean, you know, we'd give him kind of, here's the art for a location, here's, you know, a brief of what the kind of feeling is, what the main story beats are, who the main characters are. And the process was like, he'd do kind of like a sketch. For the most of them, honestly, we didn't have a whole lot of feedback. He kind of got them right off the bat. There were a couple places where it was like, either because the story was changing, or just because, you know, the original briefs weren't clear enough, where it was like, okay, this, you know, this place sounds a little bit too melancholy and sad. Or this place, you know, is a little bit too upbeat and lively. But yeah, again, for the most part, like, once kind of those location and story briefs were passed on, I mean, Steve just did such a great job with them. It's one of the very few games where, even after, you know, 2 years of listening to the music, I still didn't get sick of it.
Mm-hmm. I feel the same, actually. It goes onto the list of game soundtracks I've listened to outside of games. With like Far Lone Sails and Kentucky Route Zero and these kind of games, it's a playlist that I'll put on sometimes just to hear that kind of Clifton track and the Bartow track. I'm really fond of that music. It's really nice.
Yeah, he did such an amazing job.
Right, and it must be like quite a long and drawn out process to have the way that you're describing this multimedia process of design, of writing, of editing, of sketches and character models, of turning that into art and feeding that to the musician. Like the process of assembling this sounds huge. But so how was that process for you?
Yeah, I mean, it was, we did have the advantage of being, you know, there's just three of us on the team, and then of course quite a few collaborators, but because the core team was so small, it meant that we could move really fast. So, you know, whether it was having an idea we wanted to prototype really quickly, or just, you know, something that is like, oh, this isn't working, we're going to change it or cut it, and, you know, we could kind of make those changes super quickly and see them immediately. And yeah, I think, you know, it actually wasn't quite, I guess, as complicated as it sounds, maybe, like, because we had a lot of it established before we brought the collaborators on. It meant that kind of right away we could start handing off, like, here is, like when our writer, Kevin joined, you know, at that point, we had kind of had a lot of the outlines done. So I was like, okay, if we hand this off, they can then start kind of fleshing it out and like establishing the main story beats. Same thing with when Steve and Skew Sound joined. It was like, we already have, you know, the core art sketched out. Like, we can pass these on already. So a lot of the kind of what you would call pre-production work was done before we ever brought on collaborators. And I think that really made it easier to both like make sure that we weren't bringing on too many people until we had a really clear vision defined. And also just the material they would need to, you know, start working off of.
Well, it was a big success. It really feels like a complete piece to me. It does. It's like, I think it's rare when the visual music, the writing and concept click in quite this way. I think that's why I ended up going through it so many times. It feels like such a finished, tidy, well-crafted piece and concise piece in intention and execution. I really loved the game.
I really appreciate that. It's, I think, one of those things with, and I think this is true of all games, where it doesn't necessarily feel like it's coming together and then kind of does all together in like the last few months, and it was still definitely the case with this game. So yeah, it's a relief to hear you say that in the end it did come together.
And just to go back to the juicy world of this game for a bit, because there's so many lovely characters and places in it, I was wondering, do you have like a personal favorite? Like, if you had to go and live in one of these towns yourself or befriend one of these characters, who would you choose? And where?
Oh, the location part is hard. I love the ocean, the water. And so, like, in that way, you know, Old Moray would appeal to me, except for the fact that, you know, there's all these troubles. Like, in reality, I wouldn't obviously want to live in a city with all those troubles going on. In terms of favorite characters, though, I mean, Matilda is great. I really love her, but I think I have to go with Klaus as my favorite. I don't want to give away spoilers, but she has, I think, a really kind of interesting story development and is different in a lot of ways from most of the characters you meet.
Right. She's the most mischievous of them all, I suppose, with what she gets up to. That was actually something that I really liked about replaying it too, is that you meet, if depending on where you go, you'll meet someone at a different part of their trajectory. Like, I remember meeting the rail worker in Anchor and then not meeting him again on my first go around. And on the second go around, I met him elsewhere on the map and he had traveled. And it's the same with characters moving from place to place. And it takes several playthroughs to really patch together all of their trajectories, right? You can get a kind of a complete circle of what happened to everyone, but it does take a while. Because there's also some kind of random occurrences of characters, it seems, right? Like the first time you go to the artist colony, Pachenko, like you may or may not meet certain characters, and the same in different, they seem to trigger or not trigger on different plays through. So you'll get like a different story experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, since we knew we'd wanted to be a replayable game, and especially with narrative, it's, you know, the opening parts of a replayable narrative game can tend to be really boring because it's all the same until you start hitting those big decision points. So one way we tried to tackle that was, you know, out of the 2 to 3 characters that could start in each of the locations, we kind of randomize which one you meet first. So that, you know, to kind of give it a little bit of, you know, changing things up as you replay. And then, yeah, I mean, it was largely done, yeah, just to help with replayability. But also I think it does kind of make it interesting to kind of, how does your perception of characters change if you heard about them first from this person versus if you met them yourself first and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does take a few goes around to find them all, and you do understand characters in different ways if you get their whole story. It does give you the incentive to keep pushing through and makes the world feel alive. There's people there doing their things.
Yeah, and we did want, you know, all the NPCs to kind of have a sense that they're not just standing around waiting for you to talk to them, that, you know, they have kind of agency and their own goals and their things that they're doing, and that they're not just, they don't just exist to give you dialogue kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Right, and the theme, I'm going to write this interview up for the Radical Art Review magazine, and they have themes each issue, and the reason that I was thinking Signs of the Sojourner is a good fit is because the next theme for their issue is Precipice. And I was thinking this game really seems to thrive on that word in the kind of the setting and the idea of lives on the precipice and culture on the precipice. And do you think that that's a, how would you relate this game with that theme?
Yeah, I don't know that I had thought of that before, but that does make a lot of sense to me. I mean, a lot of these, you know, a lot of the characters are kind of like you, on the precipice of kind of these big life decisions. Do they move? Do they stay? Do they pursue different, you know, goals and careers? And also just the talents themselves that are often kind of on the precipice of going under, of being kind of abandoned and left behind. It makes a lot of sense to me.
Mm-hmm. And another game that springs to mind with that theme is Kentucky Route Zero, which seems to talk about the kind of the realities of living in a kind of a capitalist system that's gone wrong. And like Signs of the Sojourner, it doesn't flag its kind of messages and politics up front, but it's definitely there for the taking. And in that game, obviously, there are characters that are kind of falling off the edge, seemingly off the edge of the world, these towns that have kind of almost vanished because of the companies that have overtaken the local economy and kind of put people into very difficult situations. So, but Signs of the Sojourner has that too. It has these towns that are about to blink out of existence, and it does feel like it resonates in the real world as well as having this kind of welcome, fantastical edge to it that makes it good fiction and good science fiction. Do those kind of those real world moments come from experience that I guess you and your team have gone through, both in the scenario and the small town syndrome and the kind of the life changes that are in the game?
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, less so myself. Like I've driven through kind of these small, economically depressed towns that, you know, seem to kind of be emptying out and yeah, it was kind of hard to see what future was there. But, you know, I've also kind of seen a lot of small towns kind of thriving and, you know, Holly actually comes from a small town in Pennsylvania. And so I think she probably has more personal experience with, kind of what, you know, that small town feel. But yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is looking at what happens when, you know, a lot of these kind of economic systems break down and these towns don't have whatever lifeblood they used to, you know, how do they continue? You know, what does it mean or to kind of try to, keep the town going, keep the lifeblood flowing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, you know, still wanting, like I mentioned, to kind of be overall optimistic where, you know, a town like Bukomboro, kind of going the other direction and you see it kind of growing and flourishing so that it's not all kind of this, you know, bleak breakdown of the future.
Mm. Right. It's amazing how it manages to give you some of that bleakness, but to remain overall just like a really happy feeling game. I was looking over some of the dialogues. I remember little things sprang out on the first playthrough and I was like, oh, that kind of raised an eyebrow. There's one that I wrote down here from Mathilde, which is a little soliloquy that she has, where she talks about how her town's won the climate lottery. She doesn't know when the groundwater will run out where she is. That's why she meditates. The only peace she gets from watching the world die around me. And like when you see it written down, you're like, wow, that's harsh. But it's Mathilde, and she delivers it with a smile and a matcha brush in her hand, so it kind of doesn't feel harsh when she says it.
Yeah, I love that about her character, where it's, you know, she's not blind to these problems, but it's, you know, she's kind of accepted it and is, you know, making the best of it, not gonna let it get her down kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And kind of mentioning that too is, you know, that's why we wanted certain towns like the one she mentions as winning the climate lottery of, you know, these are the places that are not being, you know, so badly impacted, and then kind of reflecting how that might make the people in those towns, you know, interact with newcomers. And you kind of see that in the later game where it's a little bit of a dark side to those places. But I think you know, as climate disasters are happening, and you know, the people unaffected by those are going to be in this very privileged position, and you know, potentially kind of going down that same path.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's great for me. Is there anything that you feel like we've missed out that you would like to talk about, or are you happy with things? Is there anything we missed completely?
No, I mean, gosh, there's so much to talk about with the game, but no, I really enjoyed this talk, and I love to hear your kind of your takes on different aspects of the game.
Mm-hmm. And I'm heartbroken that DLC has been snatched away from us. I'd love to play more Signs of the Sojourner, but I guess you're working on other things now, maybe?
Yeah, unfortunately, just didn't fan out for DLC for this, but yeah, hopefully we'll have something new to talk about at some point soon. Hard to say when.
How far along are you in the process now?
Still pretty early on. Only really kind of picked up steam since the ports came out, so it hasn't been a ton of time on it yet.
Mm-hmm. Have you been happy with the reception that the ports have had?
Yeah, it's we worked with a publisher on that one, Digerati and Bromio, who did the actual porting work. And you know, it's working with them was so great. And I think it, you know, it's not that it was the most difficult controls, but I think it still feels really, really good on with a gamepad on the consoles. So I'm really pleased with that.
Okay, well, I hope it sells well for you, so well that the DLC magically reappears.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking the time today.
Yeah, it was great talking with you.
Cheers, bye.
Bye.
So I hope you enjoyed that conversation between me and Diala. Apologies once more for the terrible echo that I accidentally cast upon that interview in my editing process. I hope it wasn't too distracting, and I guess if you got this far, then it must have been okay. I'm kind of 50-50 on how I feel about that echo, but hopefully some of you who are not as auditorially sensitive to such things were able to listen to that and enjoy it. I hope to be doing some more developer interviews in the future. Really enjoyed that one, and the feedback I've gotten on the interviews that have been on the show has been really good, so I will be trying to do more in the future. And I really can't recommend Signs of the Sojourner enough. It's a wonderful game. It's really special. You can get it on Switch, PlayStation, I believe Xbox. It's also on Steam and other places like that. If you got the Itch bundle for Palestine that was on sale this year, you will have it in that, so you can play it on your computer if you did buy that bundle. If you'd like to come and follow the show on social media to find out about new episodes and to see what games I'm playing and to get involved in the conversation, you can follow Gaming in the Wild on Twitter, Twitch, YouTube, and Facebook. I do also have that Patreon account. If you're interested in supporting the show, you can head over to patreon.com/gamingin the wild for that. I'll be back next week with a new episode. Take care of yourselves and each other, and bye-bye for now.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.